Studies in Occult Philosophy by G. de Purukar. Transactions of the Headquarters Lodge. The Principles of a Buddha's Constitution. I should first like to make a few remarks about the principles of a Buddha's constitution. I wonder whether you really understand just what condition or state the principles of a Manushya Buddha are in. We human beings at the present time are in the fourth round and in the fifth root race thereof, which means that we are actively functioning from the psychological standpoint in the kama manasic parts of our constitution. When we shall have learned to function in the manasic parts, we shall then be fifth rounders, or, referring to the majority of the human race, we shall enter the fifth round. Identically so when our self-consciousness shall begin to function in the buddhi within us, we shall then be buddhas. This will not come till the sixth round. But as Gautama the Buddha, although living in this fourth round, had already so far evolved that he was self-conscious and living in his sixth principle, or in his buddhi, he was called a sixth rounder or a manushya, human, Buddha. But mark you this. When an entity such as a man in his present fourth round evolutionary degree, succeeds in living in the buddhi within him, he then has entered nirvana. Nirvana has different planes or degrees, just as the Devachan has, or the Kama Loka has, or as earth life has. But when a man has learned to function and to live in the buddhi of his constitution, he is then a Buddha, and his higher principles have entered into perfect rest and peace, nirvana. But what becomes of the inferior portions of his constitution? They still exist, because, ex hypothesi, he is still a man, they still are, they still live on, because these inferior portions of his constitution are composed of monads, just as the higher parts are. These inferior monads of the Buddha's constitution are learning, growing, evolving entities, beings. So then, in the case of a Buddha, while his highest parts have entered the nirvana, which means attained celestial Buddhahood, the buddhi manasic parts, the bodhisattva within the Buddha, still lives. And after the Buddha lays aside his physical body, or the bodhisattva within him lays aside his physical body and physically dies, for that birth the bodhisattva lives on as a nirmanakaya. And it is this bodhisattva part of the Buddha, whose highest principles are in the nirvana, which furnishes the psychological apparatus needed to embody the divine ray from the divinity and produce an avatara, as happened in the case of Shankaracharya or Jesus or Lao Tzu and others. Remember also that the avatars have no past karma, will have no future karma because they cannot live again. They never lived before, they are a product of magic, a self-conscious living compound produced by the confluence or congruence of three different currents of consciousness. The divine ray from above, the Buddha's psychological apparatus, and a bringing together of the lower elements which in ordinary course would have produced a physical human being, of the average type perhaps, perhaps somewhat higher. So then, a Buddha means that the highest parts of him are in the nirvana, that the higher intermediate or truly highest human parts of him are buddhi manasik, and this part lives on as a teacher, as a bodhisattva nirmanakaya, as a savior of men. Then there is the physical body with its vital astral apparatus which finally dies. Symbolism in the story of Jesus. May I venture to call your attention to one fact? The difficulties that have been found in interpreting the story of Jesus, of his incarnation, of his life, and of his death, arose from the fact that the would-be explainers attempt to explain unnatural and impossible things. Modern critical research has of course shown this very clearly, but a great many human hearts, devoted to their religious beliefs, find it difficult to accept the pronouncements of modern critical research and are always rejoiced when these modern critical researchers are proved to be or to have been wrong. As a matter of fact, the entire story of Jesus, later called the Christos, as outlined in the New Testament, is a mystery tale, a series of mystical legends, woven around the life of a man who did live, a great and noble man, a true sage and seer, an avatara in fact, but these mystical legends in no sense corresponded to the actual events in the physical existence of this sage. This mystery tale, you will understand, please, to mean a setting forth in dramatic form of certain very important events which took place in initiation chambers or crypts, and the parables included in this mystery tale also referred very definitely, if briefly, to certain of the fundamental teachings given to the neophytes at such times. Furthermore, as the initiatory cycle in the case of individual men simply copied the grand term of cosmic existence, therefore likewise does the Christian New Testament in its symbolic allegory and imagery, in addition to being a covered and undisclosed tale of the initiation crypt, likewise set forth the embodiment of the cosmic spirit in material existence. I will allude to one mystery fact here in illustration of the point. It is stated in the words of the story of Jesus that he came riding towards and into Jerusalem on an ass and the foal of an ass, and thereafter came upon him his life work in the earthly Jerusalem, material existence, leading, as the legend sets it forth, to his arrest, his trial before the Roman procurator, Pontius Pilate, and to his death. I would like to tell you that in the Oriental mystical cycle of the Hither East, of what is now called Asia Minor, the planet Saturn was frequently mystically called an ass, or rather the ass represented that planet in mystical symbology. And in equivalent mystical symbology the foal of the ass was this Earth, because the ancient seers said that this physical globe Earth was under the direct formative influence of the planet Saturn. When you recollect also, that the cyclical peregrinations of the monad take place strictly according to law and order in the solar system, and according to routes running from one planet to another. When you recollect also that the earthly Jerusalem according to the Jewish symbology was this earth, as the heavenly Jerusalem according to the Christian symbology, was the existence in spiritual spheres and the goal of human evolutionary attainment, you may begin to have a clearer idea of what I am briefly and in part trying to tell you. The spiritual soul rides into Jerusalem, material existence, on an ass, meaning Saturn, and a foal of an ass, meaning this earth, and the monad, the Christ spirit, descending into matter thus, is crucified on the cross of matter, that is to say is betrayed and crucified, following the Platonic imagery of the ancients. I leave this extremely mystical thought with you, because if your minds are alert and if you have profited by the instructions that have been communicated to you, this thought will give you an instance of the intricate manner in which a part at least of the Christian scriptures have been written. The one thing that you should be always on guard against is to read any single line of these Christian scriptures as recounting an actual historical physical event. Every main thought or idea in the Christian scriptures is allegorical, and refers directly to the cycle of initiation and to some of the teachings given during the initiation ceremonies. Jesus lived. Whatever name he may have had, the individual known as Jesus was an actual man, a great sage. He did indeed live. He was, furthermore, an avatara. He died, or rather he disappeared, and around his personal individuality or individual person, there was collected, there clustered, there were gathered together, events in the initiatory cycle of the Hither East which were expressed under the garments of the legends that the Occidental world now has in what it calls the Christian New Testament. In other words, the personality of Jesus the Avatara was used as the type figure around which were built up initiatory events expressed in mystical and allegorical form. And this literary material was finally whittled down into what are now called the books of the Christian New Testament. Finally, Jesus was not physically crucified, and furthermore he did not die an ordinary physical death. Opportunity in Kali Yuga. We live in a very interesting age. I do not think that in the recorded annals that are open to us at the present time there has ever been an epoch when serious-minded students of the ancient wisdom, which we call theosophy, have the opportunities that now we have. It is precisely the stress and the strain which are opening our hearts and tearing the veils away from our minds. It is the same thought that our masters have told us applies to Kali Yuga, the Iron Age, a hard, rigid age where everything moves intensely and intensively and where everything is difficult, but precisely the age in which spiritual and intellectual advancement can be made most quickly. There actually have been ages in the past when chelas or students have longed for conditions to be more difficult than they were, to give them the chance to advance faster. In the Golden Age, which it is beautiful to dream about, in the so-called Age of Saturn, in the Age of Man's Innocence, everything moved smoothly and beautifully and all surrounding being cooperated to make everything beautiful and pleasant, and there is something in our hearts that yearns to return to it, but it is not what the chela longs for. He longs for opportunity, he longs to climb, he longs to test what is in him, to grow from within. Isn't it a strange paradox that the hardest, cruelest, of all the yugas is precisely the one in which the quickest advancement can be gained? I think there is a world of wisdom in this thought, and I speak of it tonight because only a few days ago I received a most pathetic communication from one of ours who wanted to know if there was not something good in the Kali Yuga. If mankind had to go under without hope. Why, it is the very time when the chances are the most frequent for progress. It is the opportunity time. The Eucharist. The sacrament of the Eucharist was originally a teaching of primitive Christianity about the way by which the human soul could achieve spiritual oneness with the Christ within, a ray, as it were, from the cosmic Christ, thereby becoming a God-man when this union or yoga was complete. Other religions speak about the Buddha within, and the cosmic Buddha, not meaning Gautama, the Hindu teacher, but a cosmic Buddha of which Gautama was a ray, as Jesus the Avatara was a ray of what the Christians call the cosmic Christ. In a very short time, due to a number of converging causes, this beautiful and really holy Christian teaching of how to achieve this yoga or union became lost in the Christian church, and was replaced by a ceremonial. In other words, they substituted a ceremony, a ritual, a rite, to replace the occult esoteric teaching which had been forgotten except by the very few. These very few were attempting to hold back, as it were, or to restrain, the complete loss of the wonder out of the bosom of the Christian Church and from Christian thought. Many of them were originally pagans who were attracted to the new Theosophical Society, as earliest Christianity was, because they felt it had a new dispensation of spiritual power in it, and they took the Eucharist out of the ceremonies of the mysteries of Dionysus. The Dionysiacs, the Dionysian mysteries, had a communion in which the priests and the congregation together partook of the blood and of the flesh of their divinity Dionysus. The blood was wine, the flesh was the cereal, bread if you wish, or wheat. Now the Christians took this over because they knew something of the inner meaning of this Dionysian symbol, and that is the origin of what the Christians even today, carrying on a tradition but forgetting the original verities, call the holiest mystery in the Christian Church, as it originally was. Why, even today we can say that the most sacred teaching we Theosophists have, our most sacred mystery, our most occult effort, is so to live and think and study and be trained, that the individual man may become at one with the divine. We are on the upward arc, so that now we can bring about this union, some individuals more than others. When the union is complete, you have what we call a Buddha or a Christ. When the union is less complete, you have a Mahatman or one of the greatest chelas. When the union is still less complete, you have some of the great men of human history, mostly in the philosophic and religious lines. Great thinkers and teachers such as Pythagoras, and Plato, and Empedocles and other sages from Egypt and Syria and in the Druidic lands of Germany and France and Britain, or again in Persia. Then on a still lower scale you have those men who have caught the gleams of the vision sublime and have been so enraptured by the picture of that glimpse that their whole life thereafter becomes consecrate to the glory. These are Chelas and the great men of the human race. We can all become such, more or less. Here is a final thought about this. When the Dionysiacs spoke of drinking the blood of their god in the wine and taking the flesh into themselves through the cereal, the wheat, or the bread, they never intended it in the literal way in which it is now accepted in the old-fashioned Orthodox Christianity. They intended it in a mystical sense which I will now proceed to explain. The blood of the god, in the ancient countries surrounding the Mediterranean Sea, always meant the cosmic vitality, what we call jiva, the life, the divine life. Thus the blood, but the word was used as is found even in the Mosaic books of the Jews. In the blood is the life. The blood became the symbol for the life of the Christ's life, the Christ's vitality, the divine vitality in individual man which transformed him and raised him so as to become one with the Christ or with the Buddha. In that sense, by training, by effort, by yearning, by study, the neophyte raised his own life to aspire upward, to become universal, to become one with the universal life. And they called this union, or yoga, communion. The man thereafter communed with the cosmic spirit. I and my Father are one, said Jesus. And the bread, the cereal, wheat, in ancient times always had the symbolic meaning of intellect, intellectual power. Here is where you get a very interesting sideline for those who are technical theosophical students. The ancients said that wheat was originally brought to this earth from the planet Venus. Now the planet Venus in the common scheme represents what we humans in the human constitution call the higher manas, in which the Christ in us, or the Buddha in us, works. The vine, said the ancient Greeks and Latins, originally came from the planet Jupiter. The planet Jupiter, they said, is that which controls our vitality, or anima, or jiva, our life. And jiva is a direct efflux from Atman. These many and converging and correlated lines of ancient Mediterranean thought, the earliest Christians seized hold of and put together and welded fast into a lovely and marvelous teaching of union. And then later, when the truth became lost, they collected the Dionysian thoughts, changed them slightly, gave them new names, and you have the Christian communion as a ceremonial rite in the church, commemorating the process by which the sincere Christians, or one infilled with the Christos, becomes at one with the divine. This very word Christian originally meant one who is filled with Christ, one who had evoked the Christ in himself by that union, that yoga, the communion, the very thought I am trying to bring forth. Originally Christians were not called Christians. They did not dare call themselves by the title of their great avatara. Christians originally called themselves Christoi, a Greek word which meant worthy ones, or as we would phrase it today, students, learners, disciples of the Christ, and the Christians themselves tell us that they were first called Christians at Antioch in Syria, and heaven knows when that was. It may not have been until the 3rd or 4th century.